The record arrived with no label, not scratched off, not soaked away in the Kingston humidity, simply never printed. A plain shellac 78 pressed into a brown paper sleeve. No artist name, no title, no catalog number. Just a single digit hand etched into the run-out groove with something sharp, maybe a nail. The number 7. Tom Wong turned it over in his hands that evening in 1947, standing behind the counter of his dry goods shop on Orange Street, while outside the last vendors were folding up their carts, and the Kingston air was thickening with diesel and frangipani. He held the record up to the bare bulb hanging from the ceiling, squinted at it, then slid it back into its sleeve and set it under the counter with the quiet deliberateness of a man storing something he hadn't yet decided what to do with. Nobody who was there that night could later say who brought it in. Tom Wong was born into the complicated middle of Jamaican society. Not black, not white, not quite either world, and therefore by the brutal arithmetic of colonial life, both less and more than the sum of his contradictions. His family had come from China, part of the wave of Hakka and Cantonese migrants who arrived in the Caribbean through the 19th and early 20th centuries, first as indentured laborers after emancipation emptied the sugar estates of their captive workforce, and then as small merchants, shopkeepers, and traders who carved their living out of the gap between the plantocracy and the majority black population they served. The Chinese in Jamaica occupied an odd, precarious, often profitable space, trusted by neither the colonial elite nor the working poor as genuine members of their world, and yet embedded in the daily commerce of almost every community, from the deep rural parishes to the hot, crowded lanes of downtown Kingston. Tom's family ran a dry goods establishment. Fabric, flour, provisions, a bit of this and that. The kind of shop where a woman could buy 3 yards of cotton on credit and pay back pennies a week until it was settled. The shop was not a fortune. It was a foothold. And Tom, who had grown up watching his father calculate margins in a ledger written partly in Chinese characters that Tom could read only imperfectly, understood from early that survival required more than hard work. It required reading the room. It required knowing what people wanted before they knew they wanted it themselves. What Kingston wanted in the years just after World War II was sound. The city was alive with a particular kind of desperation and energy that historians have since tried and largely failed to adequately describe. The war had reshuffled things. Jamaican men had fought in the British forces, had traveled, had seen other worlds and come home to find nothing much changed except themselves. Migration to Britain was beginning. The bauxite companies were arriving. The roads were crowded with people flooding in from the parishes, looking for work, looking for something, building zinc fence communities on the edges of the city that would eventually become the garrison yards the world would later come to know as the cradles of reggae. The middle classes had their clubs and their hotels and their gramophone parties in proper parlors. The working poor and the unemployed, packed into the tenement yards of Trenchtown and Maxfield Avenue and Backawall, had each other. They had the street. And when the night came and the heat broke slightly and the rum was flowing, they had the desire to dance. Tom Wong saw this. He had always been watching. That was the particular gift, or perhaps the particular survival mechanism, of a man who existed at the margins of multiple communities simultaneously, the capacity to observe everyone without being fully claimed by anyone. He began to assemble what would become the first proper mobile sound system in Jamaica around 1947 and 1948. The technology itself was not conceptually complex. A turntable, an amplifier, an array of large speaker boxes. But in Kingston at that time, what Tom was building was extraordinary, bordering on miraculous, in the context of what surrounded it. He sourced the components piecemeal through the networks of Chinese-Jamaican merchants who had connections to Miami, to New York, to the port supply chains that fed the island. The speaker boxes he had built locally, enormous wooden cabinets that could take a sound and hurl it 3 blocks in every direction. The amplifiers were military surplus, the circuitry reworked and rewired by men who understood electricity through instinct as much as training, the records he acquired through the same transnational networks, American R&B, the raw gut-bucket blues coming out of New Orleans, Fats Domino before Fats Domino was Fats Domino, Professor Longhair tearing apart every conventional idea of rhythm, Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five making jump blues sound like it was being played specifically for the people standing in a Kingston yard. Jazz, gospel-inflected rhythm and blues from the black radio stations that Jamaica could sometimes pull in faintly on a clear night, the signal ghosting across the water from Florida or the Gulf Coast. Tom collected these records with a kind of ferocity that his dry goods business disguised. The shop was his front in both senses of the word, the face he showed the world, and the income that financed what he was actually building. The first dances he ran were small things, a yard, a stretch of road blocked off with rope, a field behind a church, whose minister had been persuaded to look the other way. He called himself Tom the Great Sebastian, the name landing somewhere between showman's bravado and the kind of aspirational title a man gives himself when no one else is likely to grant it, the Great Sebastian. There was something both magnificent and melancholy in claiming your own greatness out loud in a city that had never once offered to acknowledge it. He sets up the speakers, he runs the cables, he puts the needle on the record, and Kingston hears something it has never heard before. Not just music. It has music. Always had music. But music like this, music this loud, music that doesn't float out of a hotel window or a parlor or a mento band playing on a stage 50 yards away, music that is inside your chest, music that fills a space completely and makes that space feel, for the length of a song, like it is the most important place on earth. The people come. They come first out of curiosity, then out of need, then out of the kind of habit that is really just love wearing practical clothes. The lawn dance circuit was how it worked. Tom would set up at one location, run the dance from late evening until the small hours, then pack down and move to the next spot. Entrance fees were cheap, affordable for the yard communities he was serving, and the money he took in went back into buying more records, upgrading the amplifiers, adding to the speaker array. It was a feedback loop. The better the system sounded, the more people came, and the more money he had to make it better still. He developed an almost scientific obsession with sound quality, with the specific warmth of bass frequencies at high volume, with the clarity of a trumpet line cutting through a humid night when the air was thick with bodies and sweat and the smell of rum punch and jerked meat from the pan outside. He also developed an obsession with secrecy. The records were the weapon. In this emerging world of competitive sound system operation, and Tom understood intuitively that competition was coming even before it arrived, the records were the edge, a song nobody else had, a pressings imported from New Orleans that hadn't reached any other operator's collection, was worth more than the amplifier and the speaker boxes combined. Tom began scratching the labels off his most prized 78S, covering them with his own paper sleeves, or simply soaking the printed label off entirely in warm water. If a rival sent someone to the dance to find out what he was playing, they would see the record, hear the song, and know nothing. The practice became standard across the Jamaican sound system world, and persists, in modified form, to this day, exclusive dub plates, locked tracks, the DJ who will not name his rhythm. Tom didn't invent secrecy, but he formalized it as competitive strategy, in a context where music was commerce and the song was the product. That unnamed record, the one with the seven scratched into the groove, stayed under the counter through this whole period, silent and unplayed. It was during these early dances that Winston Cooper entered the picture. Cooper was a young man from the streets, who had a gift that Tom recognized immediately and that no one yet had a word for. Cooper could talk, not just talk, perform, translate, amplify. He understood that the space between songs was not dead time to be endured, but live time to be worked. He begins moving the microphone. He begins speaking to the crowd in a cadenced, rhythmically charged way that lands halfway between speech and song, calling out the dancers, bigging up the area, hyping the next record before the needle had even found the groove. Think about what you have been told about where hip-hop began. A South Bronx block party. A teenager named Kool Herc with two turntables. 1973. That story is true. And it begins 26 years earlier, in a Kingston yard, where a Chinese-Jamaican shopkeeper set up speakers that shook the ground and handed a microphone to a young man who hadn't yet invented a name for what he was about to do. He pulls from American radio announcer style the booming theatrical delivery he'd heard from stateside DJs when the signal comes in on a clear night, and fuses it with the patois and the rhythms of Kingston street life, the verbal sparring of the yard, the preacher's call and response, the rum bar boasting. Tom the Great Sebastian gives Winston Cooper a name, Count Machuki. Count Machuki is not simply a hype man. He is the first. He is the prototype of what would, over the following three decades, evolve into the DJ toaster, then the dancehall MC, then the rapper, the human voice riding a rhythm, not as melody, but as rhythm itself, words used as percussion and declaration simultaneously. When cultural historians trace the line from Grandmaster Flash to Jay-Z and beyond, that line runs through the Bronx block parties of the 1970s, which were themselves explicitly inspired by the Jamaican sound system tradition. DJ Kool Herc brought to New York when he migrated from Kingston as a child. And that tradition, that specific act of a man speaking rhythmically over recorded music to a crowd in a yard, was born in Tom the Great Sebastian's dance with Count Machuki at the microphone. Tom was shrewd enough to see what he had. He built the partnership carefully, creating a presentation that was part concert, part theater, part communal ritual. Count Machuki would warm the crowd. Tom would read the room, selecting his records with deliberate strategy, starting light, building the temperature, reading which songs were turning the crowd from an audience into a single organism of moving bodies, saving his strongest material for midnight and after, when inhibition had dissolved and the dance was at its most urgent. He had an instinct for the moment. People who were there described it later as something close to religious, the way the crowd submitted to what was coming through those speakers, the way the bass frequencies seemed to reorganize something in the body. But the world around Tom's dances was always already complicated in ways that pleasure could only temporarily suspend. Kingston in the late 1940s and early 1950s was a city under compounding pressures, colonial governance that was beginning to crack, independence was coming, though the exact shape of it was still unclear. Mass unemployment, the sprawling poverty of the yards where people lived five and six to a room, the violence that flickered at the edges of everything. The dances were respite. They were also, inevitably, sites of those same pressures. Men came with grievances. Arguments started. The edge between a party and a confrontation was not always clear, and Tom navigated this constantly, managing the crowd through the music itself, knowing when to drop a slower record to diffuse tension, when Count Machuki's voice needed to cut through and address something directly. Tom paid his performers, his sound boys who moved and connected the equipment, the men who worked the gate. He paid them. It was not always generous, and the records of what arrangements existed are fragmentary, but multiple accounts confirm that Tom ran a professional operation in an era when that was not the norm and not easy. He took the enterprise seriously because he understood that it was an enterprise that he had built something real, something with value, and that value needed to be protected and extended. And then from the east and from the west of his world, the rivals came. Arthur Duke Reed was a former police officer who had opened a liquor store on Bond Street with his wife Lucille, and who had more money, more aggression, and considerably more willingness to use force than Tom the Great Sebastian ever displayed. Reed was physically imposing. Photographs from the era show a large man who dressed flamboyantly, often with a crown on his head and a shotgun in his hand or slung over his shoulder, a costume that was both theater and credible threat. His sound system, the Trojan, arrived on the scene in the early 1950s and came at Tom's dances with an ambition that was openly eliminationist. This was not friendly competition. Duke Reed wanted the circuit. He wanted the crowd. He wanted to be the only name that mattered. Clement Seymour Dodd, Coxony. Sir Coxony's downbeat arrived from a different direction. Dodd was the son of a sound system operator himself, had grown up around the technology and the culture, and had contacts in the American South through the agricultural worker program that brought Jamaicans to Florida to work the crops. Those contacts meant access to records, early, deep, obscure records that hadn't reached the Kingston market through normal channels. Dodd was cerebral, where Duke Reed was physical. He competed on the quality of the music, on finding the harder-to-find pressing, on the specific sonic surprise of a record that no one in the crowd had ever heard before. He was patient and strategic in a way that would eventually make him one of the central architects of Jamaican popular music. Studio One, the label he later founded, remains arguably the most important single catalog in the history of reggae and ska. It is a Friday night in Kingston, early 1953. Coxony Dodd stands at a record counter in a crate-filled back room in Overtown, Miami, running his thumb along a row of 78S Nobody. Back home has heard. He pulls one, turns it over. The label says something in small print he has to hold to the light to read. He buys 12 copies. When he brings that record to Kingston and drops it on his system the following weekend, the crowd does not move for 3 minutes. Then it moves all at once. A single organism, the way crowds only move when they hear something that reorganizes something inside them. Duke Reed's selector, standing at the back of the crowd, tries to read the label from 20 feet away. He can't. Coxony had soaked it off on the boat home. Between Reed's muscle and Dodd's musical intelligence, Tom the Great Sebastian found himself squeezed. The mechanics of a sound system clash were brutal in their simplicity. Two operators set up in proximity, sometimes in the same yard, sometimes in competing venues on the same night, and the crowd votes with their feet and their presence. The operator with the better records, the better amplification, the better MC, the better reputation, that operator draws the crowd, and the other operator plays to diminishing returns. Word traveled faster than sound in Kingston. If Tom the Great Sebastian got beaten on a Friday night, everyone in Trenchtown knew it by Saturday morning. And here, around the middle of this story, somewhere in the early 1950s, when the pressure was mounting and the nights were getting harder, there is a detail that keeps appearing and disappearing in the oral accounts. People who were there talk about a record Tom sometimes carried with him to the dances, but never played, something he kept in its brown sleeve, something no one could identify. It's mentioned once in passing in a conversation recorded decades later, the speaker uncertain of the year, certain only that the sleeve was plain and that Tom was careful with it in a way he wasn't careful with anything else. The clash format had implications beyond the music. It imported violence into the dance hall in a way that would metastasize over the following decades. Operators hired enforcers. Records were deliberately damaged, needles dragged across rivals' most prized pressings, speaker cables cut in the dark. Duke Reed's men were particularly feared. The physicality of his sound system operation was inseparable from the physicality of his presence. You played against the Trojan with the knowledge that losing had consequences that went beyond embarrassment. Tom the Great Sebastian had built a culture, but he had built it into an environment that was becoming less and less hospitable to the kind of man he was. He was a merchant, a businessman, a man who understood profit margins and long-term asset management. He was not, at the core of it, a soldier, and the sound system world of the early to mid-1950s was becoming a war. The stress is not hard to imagine, though the historical record is thin on Tom's interior life. He was a Chinese-Jamaican man, in a world that was rapidly being redefined along lines of black cultural ownership, lines that were entirely justified, given what was being created and what had been historically taken from that community, but that had no obvious place for him. The sound system culture he had founded was rooted in the African-Jamaican communal traditions of the yard, in the spirituality and the resistance, and the specific sonic language of the Jamaican working poor. Tom had loved those things. He had served those communities. He had, in some genuine and not merely commercial sense, believed in the music. But he was not from those communities, in the way that Duke Reed was, in the way that Coxon Dodd was. He moved through them, as he had always moved through everything. As an outsider who understood insiders, a watcher who had learned to create experiences for the people he watched, that position, which had been his advantage at the beginning, became a kind of loneliness as the stakes rose. Count Machuki remained loyal to Tom through the peak years. The relationship between them was the closest thing the historical record shows to a genuine human bond in Tom's professional life. The shopkeeper and the voice, the strategist and the performer, the man who built the system and the man who made it speak, Machuki's artistry was undeniable and became widely recognized as the dances grew in scale and reputation. He was the voice of Tom the Great Sebastian's operation, in a literal sense, the sound that announced its presence, the personality that held the crowd between songs. And he was, in a deeper sense, the proof that Tom's instinct had been right, that the human voice over recorded music was not a supplement to the experience but its center. The pattern of Jamaican cultural history is in some ways a pattern of invention followed by dispossession. The people who invent are rarely the people who profit, and the people who profit are rarely the people who are remembered. This is not uniquely Jamaican. It is the history of every artistic tradition that has emerged from the Black Atlantic world. From blues to jazz to hip-hop, the relentless cycle of creation and extraction. But in the specific case of Tom the Great Sebastian, the dispossession has a particular texture, because Tom was himself neither the corporate entity nor the Black working class community at the center of the culture he created. He was the middle, the catalytic presence, the man who saw the opportunity and had the resources and the relationships to act on it first. History has complicated feelings about the middle. By the mid-1950s, Duke Reed and Coxon E. Dodd had effectively conquered the sound system circuit. Their names were the ones that defined the era, the ones that would echo forward into the history books and the documentary films and the academic studies. Reed's Trojan Sound and Dodd's Downbeat were the poles around which Kingston's musical world organized itself, and the community loyalty their operations commanded was total. Young musicians were beginning to record specifically for the sound systems. The sound system as the first distribution network for recorded Jamaican popular music, the step that would lead directly to ska, and from ska to rocksteady, and from rocksteady to reggae, and from reggae to dancehall, the whole magnificent lineage. Tom the Great Sebastian stepped back from the scene he had created. The accounts differ on the timing and the manner. Some suggest a gradual withdrawal over several years. Some describe a more abrupt exit. What they agree on is the absence, the slow disappearance of the name from the dance circuit, the consolidation of the business back into the dry goods shop, the man who had filled Kingston nights with sound retreating into the quieter commerce of flour and fabric and the daily accounting of a small merchant's life. He was not defeated in any single dramatic clash, not driven out by violence, not arrested or exiled. He simply stopped. He let the thing he had built become the thing it was becoming without him. And he went back to the counter and the ledger and the careful calculation of margins that had defined his family's place in Jamaica for two generations before him. This is, in its way, a more interesting and more devastating story than a dramatic downfall. The man who starts something and then watches it become unrecognizable, who sees his creation claimed and shaped and amplified by forces he unleashed but cannot control, is a figure that history produces with some regularity and almost never honors adequately. Count Machuki continued performing. He went on to work with other sound systems, to refine and develop the art of toasting that Tom's dances had given him a stage to invent, to become recognized in his own right as a founding figure of Jamaican DJ culture. He lived a long life and gave interviews in his later years that documented the early history of the sound system world with a specificity and a warmth that constitute much of what we know about those first dances. He spoke of Tom the Great Sebastian with respect. He spoke of the music Tom chose, the care he took with the speakers, the particular atmosphere of those early yard dances before the stakes became what they later became. In those late accounts, Tom is present as a kind of benign gravity, the man at the center of the origin story, the figure around whom the whole constellation first arranged itself. Duke Reed never acknowledged Tom. Coxony Dodd, who went on to a legacy so enormous that his absence from any conversation about Jamaican music would render that conversation nonsensical, also never prominently credited Tom as the originator of what Dodd himself refined and scaled. This is not simply ingratitude, though it is that too. It is the way that origin stories work in competitive industries. The person who perfects and scales a thing tends to displace the memory of the person who first attempted it. The Wright brothers erased the memory of Otto Lilienthal. Coxony Dodd and Duke Reed did not erase Tom Wong, so much as they simply moved so far forward that the backward view became obscured. What Tom the Great Sebastian had invented was not just a technology. He had invented a social space. The lawn dance, as Tom ran it, was a specific thing, an outdoor gathering organized around recorded music, amplified to a scale that created collective experience, mediated by a human voice that spoke directly to the crowd in its own language, in its own idiom, about its own life and its own desires. This is the template. Everything that came after, every dancehall session, every sound clash, every reggae dance in Kingston or London or Toronto or New York, every block party in the South Bronx, every rave in a warehouse, every festival main stage is downstream of what Tom Wong built in those Kingston yards in the late 1940s. The cultural consequences were not all benign. The sound system world that Tom initiated also created structures of community control and territorial identity that would become, in later decades, deeply entangled with political violence. The garrison communities of Kingston, Tivoli Gardens, Arnett Gardens, Rema, organized themselves partly around their sound systems, their dances, their musical loyalties, and those loyalties were exploited by politicians and by the criminal organizations that filled the power vacuum that colonial departure left behind. The dance that Tom had conceived as pleasure became, in some contexts, a ritual of territorial assertion that drew blood. He could not have foreseen this, but he was the first link in a chain that includes consequences he never intended. His dry goods shop on Orange Street continued. Some accounts place him still running it into the 1960s, watching the city transform around him, the independence flags going up in 1962, the ska era arriving on the radio, the skinny youths with their sharp clothes and their dangerous energy, making a new music out of the American influences Tom had first brought to Kingston. He would have heard ska in his shop. He would have recognized something in it, the American R&B DNA, the amplified bass, the urgency of it. He would have known, whether he felt pride or grief, or simply the exhausted neutrality of a man who has already made his accounting and closed his ledger, is a question the record cannot answer. It is near the end of this reckoning that the plain-sleeved record returns. Among the few personal effects attributed to Tom in the fragmentary oral histories and secondary sources that constitute almost all the documentation of his life, there is a recurring reference to a record in a brown paper sleeve. Not a collection, a single record. An item he carried with him to those early dances and brought home again unplayed, stored not with the working collection, but separately, under the counter, or in a back room, or simply wherever a man keeps the things he is not ready to release to the world. When Tom the Great Sebastian walked away from the sound system circuit, he took the record with him. No one who has since tried to account for his belongings, no family member whose recollections have made it into any archive, no neighbor or associate quoted in the documentary record, has ever described knowing what was on it. The number 7, scratched into the groove, the sleeve unmarked. Nobody who brought it, or nobody who admitted to bringing it. There is a version of the mystery that resolves into something simple, a test pressing from a Miami session, a personal recording, a song that meant something private and untranslatable, something that belonged to the part of Tom Wong that existed before and beneath Tom the Great Sebastian, the part that was just a man's son doing imperfect calculations in a ledger, written in a language he had only partly inherited. A song, perhaps, in a language he could hear, but not fully speak. A tether to somewhere he had never been, that was still, in some cellular sense, home. There is another version where the record is just a record, and the mystery is the projection of people who needed the story to have a final locked room, a last secret that explained the whole strange trajectory of a man who invented a world and then vacated it. Both versions leave you in the same place, which is standing in the silence after the music stops, in a yard in Kingston that is now probably a parking lot or a church or just gone, where once a man set up speakers that shook the ground and filled the night with something the people had been waiting for, without knowing they were waiting for it, where a young man named Winston Cooper stepped to a microphone and found a voice that changed the world, where the records, labels scratched away, told their stories to anyone close enough to hear without ever giving away their names. Tom Wong went back to his shop. The city kept dancing. The music kept moving forward through ska, through rocksteady, through the heavy spiritual weight of roots reggae, through the digital revolution of dancehall, through the bass bins shaking London Council flats, through the systems set up in Brooklyn basements and Toronto community halls, the sound that had crossed the Atlantic with the diaspora and reinvented itself in every city it touched. Duke Reed built a studio. Coxon A. Dodd built a catalog. Bob Marley took the music to the world. The world heard it and thought it began where it arrived, in a studio, on a stage, in a hit song. It began in a yard. It began with a man who carried an unlabeled record and a vision nobody else had yet formed. It began with the careful hands of a Chinese-Jamaican shopkeeper, deciding, one evening in 1947, that the people deserved to hear something louder and more alive than anything they'd been given. He gave it to them. He gave them the dance, the crowd, the bass that reorganized the body, the voice that turned music into conversation, the whole magnificent, chaotic, glorious template. He gave it and then, when the giving was done and the thing had grown past him, he simply went home. Nobody came to return the favor. The record with the 7 in the groove, whatever it held, whatever it said, whatever language it spoke or silence it preserved, went with him into that ordinary commerce of cloth and flour and the daily arithmetic of surviving in a world that had never made particular room for him. It outlasted his dances. It outlasted his name on the circuit. It may be the truest thing he ever owned. Something made only for himself, kept only for himself, played, if it was ever played, in a room where no one was measuring the sound. In the history of the music, there is almost nothing louder than Tom the Great Sebastian, and almost nothing quieter than Tom Wong. Tom Wong built the stage and then walked off it. Was that the act of a man who knew his moment had passed? Or a man who chose to stop before the thing he loved consumed him?